You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
I'm delighted to be here, and I just wanted to say that I've just come recently, well, two things. One, from speaking to PowerShift Saturday night, which is a youth-oriented event in Victoria, and I think Harjap, maybe 800 or 900 people, most of them youth, was just unbelievable energy, so just fabulous, yes. And before that, I was in St. John, New Brunswick. Now, I need to tell you, because you guys have put up such an incredible fight against the pipelines here, and we all collectively have put up such a fight against the Keystone pipeline to the south that we've held it up for 3 years. But what you need to know is that their eggs are now going into a very big basket called the Eastern Pipeline. And they have a plan now, because you guys have been so obstreperous here on the West Coast, to convert a 50-year-old pipeline that goes from Hardisty, Alberta, that goes through about halfway through Quebec, and then to build a new pipeline from there to St. John, New Brunswick, where they're going to build a deep-sea port and export it all over the world. And it's going to be, the plans now are for a pipeline that's bigger than any of the pipelines being planned either here in the West or even the Keystone pipeline, 1.1 million liters of, mostly of Alberta bitumen coming through every day. So I just want to put that in your sights when you're thinking about energy issues, pipeline issues, that we have another big pipeline fight. And it's really important that we reach out and speak to people in Atlantic Canada. There's going to be a real fight back in Ontario, and I can tell you a huge one in Quebec about it. But I'm not sure New Brunswick, people need jobs there, and they've had the government doing just a wonderful job of telling everybody that it's just going to be totally safe and all wonderful. And so the polls are showing that the vast majority of New Brunswickers want this. So it's really important that if you know any New Brunswickers, we build a movement that includes all the pipelines that we're fighting together. And the other thing that's happening in New Brunswick, I know I'm in British Columbia, but I'm still full of the struggle there. They've set aside 20% of the land base for seismic testing for shale gas fracking. And there's a First Nations blockade and a real protest growing there over, you know, there's just this huge landmass. And I say that the government there has a plan to turn New Brunswick into the Pennsylvania of Canada. They're just, you know, just all export. And guess who was there at this big, we were holding an alternative energy summit to a big Atlantic energy summit with all the corporations and the industry and the governments. And your own Premier Christy Clark was there. And she was telling them how to pull up the shale gas and export it, and this is going to be just the best thing since sliced bread. So there you were. So I was really glad we were there with an alternative message. And I have to tell you, even in the Irving papers and in Irving's backyard, we did get really good media. We were able to tell an alternative story, so that was really exciting. All right, so what am I here for? I want to talk to you a wee bit about the global water crisis and come back to this book. Basically, when I wrote Blue Gold with a colleague, we basically said the time is going to come when there are parts of the world, places in the world, where they make decisions around life and death for their reduced water supplies. And they're going to make decisions around who gets it based on corporate and private interests. And I have to tell you, it's only been, Blue Gold came out in 2002, so we're only talking 11 years later. I can actually tell you that this is happening now around the world. And that's because we have a planet that's running out of clean water, which is something we all learned in grade 6 that couldn't happen, right? We learned there's a finite amount of water, and it goes around and around in the hydrologic cycle, and it can't go anywhere, and you can't destroy it. Turns out that our teachers weren't lying, but they weren't right either, that we are polluting and displacing and mismanaging our current water stock at an absolutely outrageous rate. And if you look at the charts, the demand for water in our world is going straight up and the supply is going straight down. Lay this at the feet of what a colleague of mine calls modern water, the notion in our so-called modern society that water is not an essential element that gives us life and, you know, is there for the protection of ecosystems, but rather is a resource for our pleasure, profit, and convenience. And so we take water and we move it where we want. We dump whatever pollutants we want into it. We are pulling up groundwater around the world far faster than it can be replenished. In fact, we are pulling up the groundwater that belongs to tomorrow's generations. And we are using in our generation an amazing amount of the groundwater that should be a heritage forever. And that's partly because we have the technology to do it. In the 1950s, they developed this circular borewell technology that allowed, for instance, the desert in the United States and the Great Plains to turn from hard scrabble farming to this lush area because they were able to access the Ogallala Aquifer. Well, the downside of that is the Ogallala Aquifer will be gone in our lifetime, says the Department of Agriculture. And this is the aquifer down the spine of the U.S. West that actually feeds most of the United States and sends $20 billion of exports around the world. When I read that it would be gone in our lifetime, I thought, well, that'll be on the front page of every newspaper, but alas, no. Give you another study on groundwater overpumping around the world, which is doubling every 20 years. And the image you need to have is it's kind of like having a bathtub with a lot of water in it or water in it and people around it with blindfolds and straws and everybody's drinking that water and they can't see where it is or how low it's going, but there's lots of water for everybody until there's no water for anyone. And that's the image that we have to start to understand about these water supplies. But this study says that our groundwater takings are so intense that if the Great Lakes are being pumped as fast as groundwater around the world, the Great Lakes could be, and I quote, bone dry in 80 years. One more, I just give you two more quick ones, but just I just want you to get a flavor of what we're talking about. A new study by Greenpeace China says that in China since 1990, we're only talking since 1990, half the rivers are gone. I don't mean just polluted, they're gone, they've disappeared. They have been used to produce all of the, you know, toys and, you know, mattresses and pillows and whatever else, running shoes for the world. And we need to understand that when you create something, when you make something or you grow a commodity and you use water to do so, if you export that commodity out of the region, you're exporting water as well. It's also being used for coal fire hydroelectricity. And they're just pumping that water and actually literally destroying the water base upon which their entire economy sits. One last study, and this is one that was done by the big bottled water companies and the big food industry that uses and depends on water so much through the World Bank. And they said that by 2030, the demand for water in our world will outstrip supply by 40%. Now, that is just an astounding statistic and means that there's going to be a great deal of suffering, not that there isn't already. So what I spend time in the book trying to do is to document, and I really have footnoted and documented it very carefully, to try to put out a clarion call, because even though we happen to live in a part of the world that has more water than some, we still have a crisis coming in the world. And when there's a crisis coming in the world, it's going to hit everywhere somehow. If it only is in the face of growing refugees, water refugees around the world, needing Canada's water, needing to come here because they don't have water. We need to understand that being blessed with this water, we have the right, we have the responsibility to take care of it. And of course, then there's the human reality of if you can't pay for it in a world where the prices are just jumping so high, then you go without. And every 3.5 seconds in the global south, a child dies of waterborne disease. It is, by all measures, if you look at numbers, the worst human rights issue of our time. So setting out in this book, I didn't want to, I mean, I'm starting off with a negative because I think we have to face it head on, but actually it's a really hopeful book. Because what I've done is I've said, we can catch it. We can catch the water crisis, but we have to do it based on what I call a new water ethic. And that water ethic is that we have to put water in the center of our lives. And all policy, whether it's food production or energy production or economy or environment or trade, particularly trade, all of it must be examined in the face of what is the impact on water. And I would argue that if we ask that question about all of our policies, and can you even conceive of Stephen Harper doing that? No, you can't. But if we did, then you would have to say, well, policies would be very different. You couldn't just wantonly grow biofuels using massive amounts of water, 1,700 liters it takes of water to produce 1 liter of biofuel, to take care of a problem that we're not looking after anyway with greenhouse gases. So you can't exchange one set of issues for another. What would it look like on trade, for instance, if we took water into account? Well, you wouldn't be able to sign this agreement with the European Union, which the Harper government is planning to sign soon, they say. We're hoping not. We've held them off for almost 3 years now, which has been good. But many, many threats around trade, for instance, Veolia and Suez are the two biggest water corporations in the world. They're from France. They've wanted this deal with Canada very much because Harper is now saying to the municipalities, and this came down the pike about 3 budgets ago, but everybody missed it except me, and I was screaming around. Nobody was listening. But anyway, they're now saying to the municipalities in Canada, if you want to upgrade your infrastructure or build new infrastructure and you want federal funding, you have to privatize. You have to go to a public-private partnership. And that's the only way you're going to get this money. So we've won some. We won Abbotsford. Abbotsford said no to it. We just lost Regina. We just lost a referendum there. Very right-wing government and city council spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, I am convinced, backed by the Harper government, to convince people that this was the only way to go. So they're about to sign a 30-year contract for their wastewater services. And the companies that will bid are these two companies and others, but one of these is likely to get it. If CETA, this agreement with Europe, is signed, they would have the right, if a future city council in Regina were to say that was a mistake, which is happening, by the way, all over the world. Cities are remunicipalizing their water like crazy. If Regina in 5 years were to say we don't want to do that, they wouldn't be able to. They would have these corporations would have the right to sue for financial compensation because that wasn't the condition under which they operated. So if you started asking the question, what is the impact on water? Even when you build a new suburb, when you're planning urban design, if the question is, how can we take care of water? How can we restore watersheds? How can we protect water? I would argue that everything we do would be fundamentally different. So I argue in the book that this water ethic has to be based on 4 fundamental principles. The first principle is that water is a human right. And you may think, well, that's a motherhood. What an obvious statement. But let me tell you, it was a fierce and awful fight at the United Nations to get the recognition of water and sanitation as a human right. We were up against all the big corporations. We were up against all the modern liberal English-speaking countries, Great Britain, New Zealand, Australia, the United States, and particularly Canada under Stephen Harper, led the fight against the human right to water. They don't want to expand the concept of the rights concept, and also they would have to face what the situation in First Nations communities in this country, which is a federal responsibility. So they fought it really hard and really effectively and kept it out. But it's very important for us to know that this notion of human right to water, and I don't see it in that individualistic way, but rather a more collective way of understanding cultural and social rights, historic rights, that this, we cannot have a world in which some people or some private interest can appropriate water for private gain while other people are watching their children die of waterborne disease. And then I've been with people. I remember saying to a wonderful man named Oscar Oliveira, who led the fight in Cochabamba when they privatized their water because the World Bank told them to, and not only did the company triple the price of water, but they said, we own the water coming from the sky, and we're going to send inspectors around, and if you're caught gathering this water, rainwater harvesting, we're going to charge you for that water. So there was a revolution. People took to the streets. They brought the army in. People were killed. But they won. They stood their ground. And I remember saying to Oscar, why water? Because, my goodness, these foreign companies have come in and taken your energy and your mines and so on. And he said, water's different. Water's a standpoint. You have to take a stand on water. And he said, besides, I'd rather die of a bullet than waterborne disease. You know, it's. And I remember holding a press conference. Harjap, I think you were there when we held a press conference in Edmonton after touring the tar sands, and we had someone from the Cree First Nation there with us, a young man who spoke very passionately about watching family members die of cancer, and he said the same thing. It would be kinder to come in and shoot us one by one than pick us off with cancer, as is happening now. And it was funny, I have that clear flashback of Oscar Oliveira saying that. So the fight for the human right to water is an absolutely essential one, and the just sharing of the waters of the world is fundamental to what we're doing. The second principle is that water is a public trust and is a common heritage. And that means that water belongs to all of us. Actually, it doesn't really belong to us. It belongs to the earth and other species and future generations, but we are the collective stewards. And that it must not be privatized, it must not be allowed to be put on the open market like oil and gas and sold to the highest bidder at the highest price. And let me tell you, in business schools all over the world, that's what they're being taught, that the only answer to the world water crisis is to put it on the open market. So we have all sorts of ways in which this is happening. We have the privatization of water services, which is really coming at us here in Canada. All sorts of municipalities are now having to make this difficult decision. The Harper government should be allowing municipalities to make the decision, but no, they're forcing privatization. There's water trading. Alberta looks like the first province that's probably going to enter this, but we hear that the Clark government here may be including this notion in the draft water bill that's coming forward. Now, what this means is that this converts a license, so a corporation or a agribusiness or whatever has a license to access raw water, which you don't even have that in this province. I mean, your groundwater here is totally unprotected. But think about having the concept of a license, like a royalty. But they convert it to private property. And then they allow these corporations to buy, sell, trade these water rights. And what happened in Australia when they did that was that the big guys started eating up the little guys, and then the investments came in, and then the foreign investors came in, and the price of water went up so high that when a government 10 years later, a more progressive government, tried to buy back water to save the Murray Darling, which was no longer reaching the ocean and which was in desperate shape, they couldn't afford to buy it because the prices were now set by the private sector. So there are countries, Australia being one, Chile being the other, that are the two extremes, although there's water trading in California and Texas and so on. But these countries have gone 100% so that the water does not belong to the people anymore. And I remember asking a constitutional expert in Australia, because I said, well, you have a constitution that says water is a common good. And he said, yes, but I think the new law supersedes that. And now it would be argued in court that no, it really is has become a private property right. So that may be an extreme of where we're going, but it's you start usually with just, you know, promises that it's just going to be trading amongst like-minded farmers or whatever, but that's not what they have in mind. So there are many, many ways in which water is being privatized, and we need to understand that it is absolutely essential that the private sector, while it needs water and has a use for water and perhaps can help us find some solutions for the water crisis, the private sector must never, ever be allowed to decide access to water, because always, always for them, the profit motive has to be part of it. So we must keep water in public hands. The third principle is that water has rights too. And this principle goes a step further than water as a public trust in the notion that we say, well, water doesn't just exist to serve us. Water exists for itself. Water exists for the ecosystem. Water exists for other species. Water exists for the health of the whole biosphere, and it exists for future generations. And so we need to start thinking about how we can adapt our laws, which now see water as private property, and more, again, I keep going back to the changes Harper has made. He now says if you're going before the National Energy Board on any of these issues, you have to prove that you have a commercial interest in the issue being discussed. So being an environmental group or a community group or a citizens organization or whatever, not good enough. Being a caring citizen, not important enough. You have to prove you have an economic stake in whatever's being discussed. So only the private sector is worthy of having an opinion. And we're seeing that all over the world as we modernize, and this is not, of course, part of traditional heritages or traditional Aboriginal or Indigenous cultures, but as we get more modern, we tend to see nature serving us, and so our laws are very clear that that's what is happening. The concept of the rights of nature says the opposite, that we have to learn to make our human laws more compatible with the laws of nature if we and the planet are to survive. And so there are very exciting things happening. Countries like, Ecuador has become the first country in the world to actually adopt the concept of the rights of nature in its constitution. Yes. And we have a number of ordinances. We're working with friends in the U.S. that are fighting against fracking, fighting against bottled water takings, fighting against privatizations and so on, by saying that the water in their area has its own fundamental rights. Sometimes they go to their municipal council. Sometimes they just pass the resolution themselves and sort of dare higher up governments to override them because the majority is speaking so strongly. But they have actually kept fracking out of some areas. In New York, there are hundreds of local ordinances against fracking. And when it comes off the ground like that, it makes it much more difficult for levels of government here and even here to ignore. And very exciting development in this is something called the Universal Declaration on the Rights of Mother Earth, which a number of us put together in Cochabamba, Bolivia, after the failure of the 2009 climate summit in Copenhagen. And some of you will remember that was the time at which there was so much hope that something would happen, and it turned out so badly, and people's wishes or hopes for a successful conclusion were really dashed. I got off the plane in Copenhagen, this is a modern, liberal government. They suspended civil liberties for 2 weeks before and during, and then 2 weeks after, and they could arrest anybody, deport anybody. If they didn't like the way you looked at them, they could deport you. And they were awful to the youth, just awful. The stories I could tell you. But anyway, so when I got off the plane, we were all met by young people wearing little Coca-Cola outfits, little red outfits, and little cups of Coca-Cola welcoming us to what they called, are you ready for this? Copenhagen. Instead of Copenhagen, it's Copenhagen. And so everywhere you went, there were billboards and signs and videos of happy children running through clean meadows and lovely water. So it was like the climate summit brought to you by the UN and Coca-Cola. So I started, of course, calling it Copenhagen, and my indignation built as during the entire time. And as we left, we were staying in an apartment, rented an apartment from somebody who had the sense to get out, and the police were all around our area, and they kept the dogs howling all night. I know they kept them hungry because we saw it. The dogs didn't sleep because the dogs didn't get fed, so that they would have those dogs angry and hungry during. No, it was really something to watch. They had security from all over Europe. It was really scary. But anyway, so when I got to go home to go on the plane to go home, a little elf came up to me with Coca-Cola to say goodbye, and I'm afraid I used the F word on I feel badly. If I could find the elf, I would apologize, but it was just like, enough, Copenhagen. There's no hope left at Copenhagen. It was a bad week, right? So as a consequence, we all were invited by Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, to come to Bolivia. He expected 7,000 or 8,000, and 37,000 of us descended on him. Yes, it was fabulous. And we created something very, very exciting, which we then presented to Ban Ki-moon. I actually had the pleasure of being in that presentation, and then launching into the world. And I really want us to think a step beyond water as a public trust, which it is, but that water has rights as well. And that means that we have to preserve water, we have to restore watersheds. And just when we think about climate and water, we always think about climate chaos induced by greenhouse gases and how that impacts water, which it does, but we don't think the other way. And that is when you remove water or vegetation from a water retentive landscape, you affect the hydrologic cycle. You create desert, you create heat, you create more global warming. The way we are treating water is one of the major causes of climate chaos. And one of the major ways that we're going to deal with climate chaos and global warming is restoration of watersheds, restoration of healthy water retentive landscapes. So the fourth principle then, and then I'm going to shut up and talk with you and not at you, is that water can teach us how to live together. And this principle really asks the question, is the scarcity of water, and believe me when you see the charts, I said this before but I'll say it again, the demand is going straight up in an arrow and the supply is going straight down. This is a recipe for possible conflict, competition, violence, and even war. And I describe in the book many conflicts that are taking place around the world, within countries, between big thirsty megacities that are going out and just confiscating water, usually from indigenous territories, and just taking the water. There's more of us than you. There's nothing you can do about it. Between rich and poor, between nations trying to share a declining watershed. We also know that water is being used as a weapon of war and a weapon of terror in places like Palestine, Syria. Water is very much a part of the Syrian story. The Syrian Assad turned over a massive amount of water in the north where Kurdish peasants were living small landowners were living to big industrial agribusiness, gave it to his cronies, displaced them from the land, and they ended up going to the cities, which is where the revolution started. There's a real water story in the Syria story that hasn't been widely told, and so on. I mean, we're seeing this around the world. At the same time, or should I say, hopefully at the same time, I believe that instead of water being a source of conflict for us, that water could become nature's gift to humans to teach us how to live together better on this earth. And I've got many examples of groups coming together and saying, you know, we have these differences, but this common water, this common river, this common aquifer is going. And if we don't come together and find a way to share this thing, and by sharing, it's not just this is how much I get, and this is how much you get, but how do we together find a way to save this water system? And there's some miraculous stories around the world of how disparate groups are coming together to find peace, and water serves as a form of peacekeeping and peacemaking even for warring factions. And I like to think about the notion that water can be this gift from nature to us to teach us how to live together. So because this is a book event, I'm going to do a short little reading, which I don't usually do, but usually you do now for these things. So it doesn't look like my book just because the printing's a little bigger here, but it is my book. So I'm just going to read to you a tiny little bit out of the book around the fight for the right to water at the UN, because this is a story I love. And then I'd just love to open this up and discuss it with you. In 2008, I was given the honor of serving as senior advisor on water to Miguel Descoto Brockman, the newly elected 63rd president of the UN General Assembly. President Brockman, or Father Miguel as he preferred to be called, is a Nicaraguan priest by training with a long history of deep commitment to social justice issues. On taking office, he publicly declared his concern about the impact of the global water crisis on the poor and pledged his support for a General Assembly resolution recognizing the human right to water and sanitation. Without his direction and support, I doubt we would have been successful. President Brockman contacted me just before he took office and invited me to advise him and guide the process toward a General Assembly resolution. It was ironic in a way that I should be chosen for this task, as it was the Canadian government under Prime Minister Stephen Harper that led the opposition to any formal recognition of the right to water at the United Nations. When I spoke at committees and panels, the Canadian representatives generally left the room. Except one day, this one, she put a big bottle of Fiji water, and I don't know if you've ever read about Fiji water. The Fijians are being denied their own water. It's a really awful story. Fiji water is the worst, the absolute worst of all of the waters. And so she put this great big expensive bottle of Fiji water right up there so I could take a look at it when I was speaking. Ah, yes, I love Stephen Harper and everybody connected to him. No country was stronger in its support than Bolivia and its president, Evo Morales. Bolivia was one of the 20 countries that challenged the ministerial statement at the 2009 Istanbul World Water Forum because of its refusal to recognize the right to water. Bolivia's ambassador to the UN was Pablo Solon, a passionate human rights advocate and son of the famous Latin American muralist Walter Solon Romero, who depicted his people's suffering in his powerful art. I had worked with Pablo before he was ambassador to the UN, and on one of my trips to Bolivia, he introduced me to the newly elected President Morales. I put my case to him that Bolivia should lead the crusade for the right to water at the UN, and Evo Morales gave me his word that he would. In June 2010, Ambassador Solon presented a draft resolution on the human right to water and sanitation to the General Assembly to intensive criticism. Many member states fought the process, arguing that the world was not ready for this step. Some counseled waiting for more research. Others tried to have Solo weaken the clear language of the resolution and drop the reference to sanitation. Solo refused, rightly citing that lack of sanitation is a leading cause of death and must be included. Others demanded he add the words access to water and sanitation, but again, Solon refused, noting that changing the wording to include access would let states off the hook by allowing them to argue that private companies were offering these services and therefore their own obligations were fulfilled. Pablo Solon would not budge. He declared that he would rather have the resolution defeated than diluted, and said that he would like to see which countries would stand up in the General Hall of the United Nations and vote against the human right to clean water and life-giving sanitation. While the debate raged on, I and our staff and allies were lobbying individual member states to gain the needed votes. On July 28th, nearly 2 months later, and after much wrangling, 39 countries, mostly from the Global South, presented the final resolution to the General Assembly. It said, "The General Assembly recognizes the right to safe and clean drinking water and sanitation is a human right that is essential to the full enjoyment of life and all human rights, and called upon all member states and international organizations to assist developing countries to," and I quote, "provide safe, clean, accessible, and affordable drinking water and sanitation for all." Pablo introduced the resolution by reminding the Assembly that humans are composed of about two-thirds water, and our blood flows like a network of rivers to transport nutrients and energies to our bodies. Water is life, he said. Then he laid out the story of the number of people around the world dying from lack of access to clean water and quoted a new World Health Organization study on diarrhea, showing that every 3.5 seconds in the developing world, a child dies of waterborne disease. Ambassador Solon then quietly snapped his fingers 3 times and held his small finger up for a half second. The General Assembly of the United Nations fell silent. Moments later, it voted overwhelmingly to recognize the human rights to water and sanitation. The floor erupted in cheers. The countries that opposed the resolution did not actually vote against it, they abstained. This was the best signal yet that the debate was over, that the debate over these fundamental rights was finally winding down. Despite this, the abstaining countries still made a number of angry speeches after the vote, accusing Bolivia of forcing a vote no one was ready for. Solon stood with his arms folded across his chest and a small smile on his face, letting the bitterness pass by him like air. Thank you.